repeal of the death penalty in New Hampshire is close to becoming reality. Professor Buzz Scherr joins me to discuss. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, what started this being a topic of interest for the state legislature?
Well, it's been a topic that's been in the state legislature on and off for the last 20 plus years. So, you know, 20 years ago, it didn't have many votes. 10 or so years ago, both houses of the legislature passed a repeal bill, but then Governor Shaheen vetoed it, and there was not enough votes to override it. Last session, both houses passed a repeal bill. The Governor Sununu vetoed it, and it missed by two votes in the state Senate overriding the veto. This year, again, both houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate, passed it. This time, it passed both houses with what are veto-proof majorities, more than two-thirds of each house. So, and then Governor Sununu last Friday, if I'm not mistaken, a week ago today, vetoed it. And so sometime probably in the next 2 weeks or so, there will be a veto override session.
So they got to hold another vote to confirm that, yes, we're going to bypass the veto.
Exactly. They're going to overrule the veto. And it looks like it's the most likely this time around that the death penalty will be repealed. You never know. And much of it is probably going to depend on turnout. You know, does everybody in the House of Representatives show up? who shows up? Who doesn't show up? You know, there's all sorts of inside baseball type of stuff. But this is going to be an interesting time.
Is there a certain aspect to this that really made them want to bring this up again, or?
It's been what we've seen around the country is that the feelings about the death penalty have been evolving around the country and in addition in New Hampshire. And I think a good piece of it has been, again, around the country and in New Hampshire. Two things. One, it's expensive to execute somebody.
Right.
You know, Michael Addison, who's on death row in New Hampshire, they've already spent over $5 million. They haven't even built a chamber, a gas chamber, in which they would execute him.
Oh, really?
Or a lethal injection chamber in which they would execute him.
So, yeah, a lot of people don't consider the fact there's a tremendous amount of appeals that go through before someone is actually executed after sentencing.
It takes easy 10 years.
Right.
If someone chooses to go forward with appeals, it takes easily 10 years of state and federal litigation. And they're, you know, they're about $5 million on both sides into it. They probably spend close to $8 to $10 million on the appellate process, putting aside, you know, building the facility where the execution can occur. So you contrast that to it cost a high estimate about what it costs to incarcerate someone for a year in New Hampshire is loosely $40,000. It's actually closer to $30,000, but let's say it's $40,000. If you incarcerate that person for 50 years at $40,000 a year, that's $2 million.
A lot less.
So, you know, so the alternative, a life without any chance of parole, is a lot cheaper. And, you know, that resonates in New Hampshire. And the other thing that resonates everywhere and is increasingly resonated since innocence projects have been in place around the country is the risk of making a mistake. We know from all the work the National Innocence Project has done over the past 25 years that we've executed innocent people. We also know that over 250 people have been found to have been wrongly convicted based on DNA testing after the fact, post-conviction DNA testing. came off death row because of that.
To be convicted, you got to be beyond a reasonable doubt, supposedly, yep, convicted, which, especially with DNA evidence not really being as powerful in the 90s as it is today, where there's been a lot of issues with how evidence was being handled, because people just didn't know how to handle.
And in addition to that, there are some cases where, you know, there's not DNA evidence in every case.
Yeah.
Number one. What we've also seen through the Innocence Project data and other data is in a, you know, a study of the first 260 or so exonerations based on DNA evidence, the Innocence Project went back and looked at the circumstances of each of those convictions and came up with some really breathtaking information. In about 50% of those cases, there is at least some kind of eyewitness identification. That is, somebody said, that's the person who sexually assaulted me. That's the person who I saw kill the defendant, or that's the person who came out of the house where the dead body was found, or, you know, some version of 50% of those exonerations, there was eyewitness identification.
Which is notoriously unreliable. People are not reliable when it comes to being in the heat of the moment trying to recognize a person after
but
the fact.
But often viewed by juries as the gold standard, yeah, one of the two gold standards. What's the other, one of the three gold standards? What's the other two gold standards? Number two, forensic evidence. There's, you know, about 20% of the cases there was faulty forensic evidence of some sort. Let me give you one example of a case in Harris County, Texas, where Houston is. A guy named Josiah Sutton was identified as, was arrested as a perpetrator of a sexual assault. His victim kind of identified him. They did DNA testing, and the Harris County DNA lab said, this is the guy. He went to trial. The victim wasn't as certain as some victims are about this being the right guy, but the DNA evidence convicted him. He got a lengthy jail sentence. 5 years later, they were doing an audit of the Harris County DNA lab for reasons completely unrelated to Josiah Sutton's case, but they reran the samples in Josiah Sutton's case. They had made a mistake.
Wow.
They had the wrong guy. So even DNA evidence is not flawless.
Right.
You know? And then finally, the most breathtaking statistical bit of information. In almost 30% of those first 260 exonerations, the person who was exonerated confessed to the crime. That is, confessed to something they clearly did not do.
Right, which is, I mean, you hear about that all the time nowadays, especially, yeah, with all these true crime podcasts out there that are releasing it. It's fascinating to hear the ways people are coerced or just don't really remember and think, I must have done it, I just don't remember.
Or they're a very vulnerable population, right, one way or another. So what we've learned from the first 25 years of the Innocence Project is our criminal justice system makes mistakes. So then it raises the question in terms of a death penalty. How many innocent people being executed are too many before we get rid of the death penalty?
And fortunately, in New Hampshire, it's only been used once over the last
60 plus years, 65
yeah,
years, I think it is.
39, I think it was when it happened, if I remember right from the article. I'm also going to list a link to the Concord Monitor article, yep, that covers this in the episode description. So if some of the numbers are a little off, check the monitor. They actually have editors.
So, you know, it's not used that often.
Right. And which is why they got to build a chamber for this case.
I mean, it used to be death by hanging. That used to be the method in New Hampshire.
Wow.
I think in particular the Innocence Project stuff and the testimony in front of the legislature from people who have been exonerated, what it was like for them. I think the efforts of Representative Rennie Cushing, who has been a longtime advocate of repeal, and who's the prime sponsor of this session's repeal bill, has been very powerful. His family, his father, was killed by a police officer with whom he had some sort of beef. And Rennie has been an advocate for abolishing the death penalty since then. He's been a very powerful victim's advocate. he's led the charge in the legislature and statewide. So you can't underestimate how important his contributions and his efforts have been and sticking with it and keeping at it year after year. And,
you know, this must have ended up being bipartisan.
Very much so.
I mean, or 58 veto proof.
In the Senate, state Senate, where the split is 14 to 10, Democrats, Republicans, the vote to in favor of the repeal bill was 16 to 7. In the House of Representatives, there was well over two-thirds, and the Democrats don't have a two-thirds majority. So, yeah, it's been bipartisan.
Before we jump into Governor Sununu, I was shocked to hear that Governor Shaheen also vetoed it.
Yeah, Governor Shaheen was the first to...
Because she's a Democrat.
She's a Democrat. I think... in addition to whatever her beliefs were, mm-hmm. I think there were some politics involved. She was the first Democratic governor in a number of years, in a couple decades, number one. Number two, she was a moderate Democrat, mm-hmm. and she appreciated, I think, politically the fragility of her status as the first Democratic governor in many years. This was, to be blunt, probably not a circumstance that she was willing to expend a lot of political capital on, given her situation politically.
No, also because it's not used much. I mean, it doesn't seem like something you'd want to risk your reelection on so quickly, because our terms are 2 years for
every
governors.
Every 2 years.
That's a quick turnaround for public office.
And it's not like the majorities were big in the Senate and the House when the year that it passed and she vetoed it. Mm-hmm. You know, I assume there was in part a political calculation in addition to her beliefs. It's been a long road for repeal, and, you know, knock on wood, it's going to happen this year. I think the proponents of repeal are holding their breath, but, it's been interesting to watch the momentum build over the last 20 years.
Now, Governor Sununu actually put in his veto in Manchester a couple days ago, I think it was,
yep.
With a bunch of police officers.
The widow of Michael Briggs,
right.
the police officer who Michael Addison was convicted of killing. And that's a powerful image.
I mean, is the law enforcement angle the primary reason he's given?
And his personal beliefs.
Yeah.
But he thinks, I think he believes it has a deterrent effect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the data is out there that really supports that, but I understand the feeling behind the police officers in Manchester. They've lost one of their own. I understand, such as anyone can understand, how difficult this must have been for the widow of Michael Briggs. Interestingly, and by contrast, Michael Briggs' partner is not a proponent of the death penalty in this case.
I thought it was interesting that New Hampshire has very strict death penalty scenarios where that would happen for anyone that's interested in. The monitor lists, it's the killing of non-duty law enforcement officer, judge, murder for hire, murder during a rape, certain drug offenses or home invasion, and murder by someone already serving a life sentence without parole.
That's not unusual around the country.
Really?
In southern states, there are more expansive criteria for the kinds of crimes that qualify as capital crimes.
Insert your Texas joke.
But that's not an unusual set of crimes.
Right.
And seems like, if you read the statute, rigid set of procedures before you can a jury can vote to execute somebody. But that said, you know, there are 250 people who came off a death row, many of them in states where they had very similar rigid procedures, and that the individuals had high quality counsel. You know, it varies from state to state. In some of the southern states, given what they pay appointed counsel, some of the counsel, which is nothing almost, some of the counsel's performance in capital cases in some southern states is really abysmal. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case where the U.S. Supreme Court said, it is not per se ineffective assistance of counsel for a defendant in a capital case is counsel to fall asleep during a portion of the penalty phase. That kind of captures some of the scary aspects of what's happening in some states in terms of the quality of representation. But even with high quality representation, mistakes are made.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Innocence, always a chance.
That's what the Innocence Project data has told us. That mistakes are made, even in the best of circumstances, and that's scary. You know, it goes back to me, the one of the fundamental questions, which is, are we willing to tolerate even one innocent person being executed in order to continue to have a death penalty? Because we know it's happened. We know it's going to continue to happen. And, you know, the other message that I think some in the legislature are getting is a really profound moral, political question, which is the right way to convince people it's wrong to kill somebody else, to kill people?
That's kind of the way I usually hear it framed, is there's so many convoluted moral arguments for it.
I very much understand the need and the desire for revenge. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very, very powerful human instinct. And that's why we build these intricate sentencing systems to try and take that piece of emotion out of the sentencing decision, whether to execute somebody or not. But I'm not sure we're successful at that at the end. And you know, the broadest message, we're going to show you it's bad to kill people by killing people.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.